blood with your patron saint. Cover up the cracks with a lick of paint. All the exits are double locked, because Saint Sebastian sways but doesn't walk.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO in Portland, and you're listening to Between the Covers, our show about books and things related to books. This morning, I am so happy to have with me Todd Davies, who has a list of accomplishments four arms long. She's been a screenwriter, a producer, independent filmmaker, a radio host, a teacher, and a cocktail waitress.
You have to pay to do those things.
That's true. And now she is an independent publisher of Exterminating Angel Press and an author. Some of her latest books are the Arcadian Trilogy, which is Snotty Saves the Day, Lily the Silent, and The Lizard Princess. And she also has two wonderful food memoirs, Jam Today and Jam Today 2, The Revolution Will Not Be Catered. Good morning, Todd Davies.
Hello, Lynn.
We are here this morning to talk about the importance of story, which couldn't be more basic in literature. You know, the poet Muriel Brukhiser says we are not so much made up of atoms as stories.
It's completely true. It's not just important about literature, and that's something I'm always banging on about. It's important in life. Your life is your own story. You're making up stories all the time, which make you see the world the way you see it. We're making up cultural stories en masse, which make the world the way that we see it. In the same way that bees make honey, we make stories.
In politics, it's always control the narrative.
It is indeed. And I was asked recently about what story had to do with the present election cycle.
This is a July 2016, so we're smack dab in the middle of an election cycle that is.
And essentially what we're smack dab in the middle of is competing stories, that everyone agrees that something's broken. Everyone agrees on that. But the narratives about how to proceed from that place are completely different.
Well, even folks that talk about fact-based, I'm a fact-based person. Well, that's because you like that story.
Mm-hmm. It's really funny. When people do that, I start laughing because, yes, what facts? Which, I mean, there are definitely facts that we can all agree on. That's definitely.
Gravity.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, or.
It's a theory, they say.
I mean, there are things that work. There are stories that work. But also, if you look back over human history, the theories that work have changed. They change. And some theories work for some things and some theories work for other things. Most of our stories that we use culturally are what I would call yang influenced rather than yin influenced. They are more focused on the mind rather than the body, on thought rather than feeling. This is like maybe a little unbalanced. Maybe we need a little bit more yin in our stories.
There are so many dystopian stories these days, and I'm starting to, though I used to kind of like them, I'm starting to feel that that's harmful.
Me too.
So why do you?
Well, I mean, I really, obviously there's a place for them and there's brilliant dystopian stories, but we are getting to the point where we really need some new stories. We need what Walida Emerisha calls visionary fiction, where we actually envision what we would like the world to be like and come up with what even might seem like insane ideas, because there have been many insane ideas. Galileo rebuked Kepler for believing that the moon influenced the tide. Galileo, he said, that's a little irrational, Johannes. You really need to back off from that one. Well, he was wrong about that. And there are possibly other stories going around that things are wrong which aren't wrong, and that things are right which perhaps aren't right now, because things change. That's a wonderful thing about story, is that our stories change, and they should. They should be continually creative, because life is continually creative and life is continuous change, distressing as that might seem. But if you let yourself go into the current, it's actually more fun to swim there than it is to be fighting it.
It's the current of imagination. The times we're in, to me, and I'm stealing this from Michael Mead,
still from the best, Lynn.
That's right.
You're doing that. That's good.
That we are suffering from an extreme lack of imagination.
I think he's totally right. I mean, you're the one who introduced me to Michael Mead, to his work, and he's totally right about that. I'm really enthusiastic about so many of the things that he says. And one of the things that I'm really enthusiastic about is that he, as well as My Arcadia series, he looks back to look forward. He looks back at stories and says, what did we lose when we thought that story wasn't working? He looks back at Native American fiction or legends. He looks back at myth. He looks back at folktales and then brings them up and says, these have so much to say to us today. I love that.
Which brings us to the Arcadian trilogy, which is definitely, seems to me, your way of looking forward and progressing with fairy tales, which are
biologically true.
Biologically true.
I mean, that's what the physicists of Arcadia have discovered, that fairy tales hold all the biological truths of humanity, which they do. They actually do. When you hear somebody say, that's so childish, really look out. Pay attention, because that's the childish thing is usually where the next truth is going to come from. And fairy tales hold so many truths about what our desires are, what our real human desires are, what our goals are. I do have to say that one of the problems, I have a problem with dystopian literature continuing now, because it's nothing but saying the world is terrible. How many times can we say that? Of course there's suffering in the world. Of course things go wrong. But what do we want to go right for a change?
And you put these ideas forth in the trilogy of Arcadia. Now, the first, Snotty Saves the Day.
Indeed.
Is about this fellow. You want to describe Snotty? And where did he come from? Where did the idea of Snotty come from?
I was working in Liverpool, in England, in what was considered one of the most deprived neighborhoods in the EU. And I loved living in that neighborhood and working in that neighborhood because it was so lively and creative, as often happens in deprived neighborhoods. And I was setting up, it was my social activism period. And I'm still will do anything, but I was really pushing on this one. And I set up a project with a bunch of other people to get kids back into education through making their own television programs. Because, we had kids who couldn't read, who were age 12. It was scandalous. It really was. So I had a lot of connection with the juvenile authorities and with the local police. And there was a story about a kid in the neighborhood that got in the newspaper when I was there. The kid had just been arrested at age 12 for running a drug ring of 7 adults in Wales since he was 10 years old.
Rather enterprising young fellow.
Indeed. And the only reason they caught him was because his mother reported him missing 6 months after he stopped coming home. 12 years old, right? So, and I was in communication with a lot of, they call them ministers in England, the people that run the government in London. And I was in communication with a lot of them because we got a lot of funding from the Labour government at that point and from the EU. And I went down to London and I said, do you know what you guys have done? You have just put away a kid who could have solved so many of your cultural problems.
Yeah.
This is like you were dumping your oil into the North Sea. Do you understand what you've done? You've ruined his life. You've taken away a kid who could run a drug ring of 7. And they're all looking at me like I'm making some kind of hilarious paradox. They thought that was really funny. But it's really true. Think about it. Mm-hmm. What he'd been forced to do, right, to make a name for himself. So I thought a lot about that, and I was going back and forth, which was insane, but I was going back and forth between Oregon, of all places, and Liverpool. And when I would come back to Oregon, my husband would say, this is like Toy Town. We would come back, and everyone's happy, and the bread man's delivering the bread, and everyone waves at us when we get off the plane, and, we know everybody. And I was thinking, is it possible for this to actually grow, for a community that's actually happy and safe, to actually grow and become worldwide? And why? Why can't it? Or will it fall down? What will happen to it if I play with that? And if I take that kid and put him through a sort of Alice in Wonderland scenario and have him find out who he really is and release that energy and form a little community in the midst of all the horror that kid lived in. And they wouldn't even let me talk to him because he was a juvenile. I tried to track him down, and they said, we totally get that you want to talk to him, but you can't. We're sorry. So I have no idea what's happened to him. So I think he has still stuck with me. How many years ago was that now? It must have been 16 years ago when this happened. And I still think about that kid every week pretty much. I think about that energy and that energy lost. And so Arcadia started from, what if we found that energy? And that formed a little pocket of change. What would happen to the little pocket of change if it was surrounded by pressures to not progress, to cave in to the idea that the only thing you could do as a 10-year-old, if you really had ambition in a neighborhood like that, was become a drug lord, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the Arcadia trilogy, and it's continuing because I still want to know. I mean, the one I'm working on now is a sort of, well, I can tell you, it's sort of Frankenstein. It's my villain has created a sort of Frankenstein, and he's reporting to the larger community, to Megalopolis. He's reporting on his little community of Arcadia because they want to just take it over because it's the only place left on their world that has natural resources still because they've ruined their natural resources entirely in Megalopolis, especially water. They have lots and lots of water, and Megalopolis doesn't anymore because they had a huge flood after they had a huge deluge and earthquake, and it got salt and everything.
Well, so the next character in the series is Lily the Silent.
Mm-hmm.
And what
can we say where she came from?
Yeah.
Okay, well, she's where Snotty came. That's what Snotty turned into. She turned into a queen. It turned out Snotty. The only thing worse than being a little boy in a terrible neighborhood in Megalopolis, a little mixed-race boy, would have been to be a little mixed-race girl in that neighborhood. And so what Snotty realizes at the end of the book is that he's actually a little girl. He just decided he needed to up his game when he was very small. So he takes that in, and he changes his world entirely and becomes the queen, the first queen. And the next book is about her next adventure with battling with Megalopolis. And that was meant to be sort of a teen book. My idea was that the first book would be a children's book, but it's footnoted by the Arcadian scientists. So you can read it, I hope, with a lot of pleasure as an adult, because they write a lot about the folk tales of Arcadia versus those of Megalopolis. And then the second book was meant to be a sort of YA love story, but with a bittersweet ending,
mm-hmm.
which...
It's all good love stories.
Well, indeed, and I wish I'd had more of those when I was a teenager. I think that was why. You know, something a little bit more truthful about how you could really, really love somebody and they might not be up to the job, you know? And that maybe you need to go on and do your own thing and do your own duty, do the job that you were meant for, even though it means you can't stay back in that love relationship. And then the third book is about her daughter who... goes on a quest, who's the great queen of Arcadia. And she goes and has many, many adventures as the lizard princess and then comes back as the queen. And I thought that was going to be it, but then they just keep talking to me, these people.
I just want to let our listeners know that you are listening to KBOO. This is Between the Covers. I'm Lynn Mollick. I'm here this morning with Todd Davies. She is the publisher of Exterminating Angel Press, a small and wonderful publishing concern, Oregon-based.
Yay. Pacific Northwest, Cascadia.
And we are talking about the importance of story this morning. And part of what we are speaking of are three of Todd's books, the Arcadia Trilogy. And we're also talking about the importance of changing the story. So speaking of the importance of story, and what stories are you, Todd, really interested in right now?
Well, I'm really interested in this idea of risk being necessary to the human community, that human beings have a need for risk.
And look what we're doing risk-wise.
Well, indeed.
Paying any attention.
That's right. That's
to
right.
To some very important climate concerns.
And many other concerns, too. There's a fascinating book, which people don't seem to read anymore, and which I only found as a small footnote in a Penguin edition of Frankenstein in the foreword by a scientist who's now dead named Brian Easlea. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's E-A-S-L-E-A. And he wrote a fascinating book, which I recommend to everybody, called Fathering the Unthinkable. And it's about how the love of risk brought about a scientific climate that fathered the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb, and how what seemed to us to be completely irrational moves on the part of those scientists makes total sense to them, given this absolute idea that they have that risk is what human beings are made for, and that that's the only thing that drives creativity, and that that's our goal, is to have interesting risk at all times. So I'm really interested in that, because that is what happens in Frankenstein, that Victor just can't resist risking everything in order, as he says, to reach for the stars, you know, and the guy that finds him, Captain Walton, where the story is framed, it's a guy who's writing back to his sister because he's taken all these men on this journey to the North Pole. And he writes about how he's left behind the most wonderful world and relationships, and he's never going to see his sister again. But it's worth it because it's a risk, and that's what human beings are for. Well, human beings definitely love risk. But when you make it an absolute, when you say that's what human beings are for, then you run into trouble. And that's what I'm really interested in right now is, are we telling ourselves the story that says we must risk all or we are not interesting? Brian Easley quotes Laura Nader in his book. She's Ralph Nader's sister, but she's a scientist, and she was at Berkeley, in fact, when I was a student there. She was on an environmental committee of some kind for the government, and she was the only woman in the 80s. And she said she couldn't get anyone else on the committee, all men, she couldn't get any of them interested in talking about solar, wind, or wind power, because they said to her, it's not as interesting as nuclear, because nuclear is riskier.
Holy cow.
Uh-huh. So that's driving a narrative that we can be a hero because we have to risk all in order to achieve and in order to triumph over our fellows.
That the hero narrative to me is dead.
It's done.
It's done its job.
And it was a great job. Thanks, hero narrative. Got us out of the Neolithic period. Got us here. Got us all sorts of wonderful things. Medicine, dentistry, toilets. Thanks. You're done. And what we're hoping for is a partnership narrative now. Have you read Frankenstein? Have you ever read the original?
Yeah.
You know that it's the 200th year anniversary of when she wrote it.
I did not.
And I'm actually going to bring this book out on the 200th year anniversary of when she published it, which would be 2018 in May. And Victor Frankenstein, what he essentially does is he lives in Arcadia. He lives in the most wonderful world. He has the most wonderful family. He lives in the most, you know, a lovely community. He's got this woman he's going to marry who's just great. And he just can't let himself not think about being the greatest man of all time in creating life. So he does. And then he backs off of that. And then what he's created ends up destroying his entire world. Now, does that narrative sound like anything that's happened in the 20th century? Scientists who then get so excited about a problem that they go and they solve it, even though it's potentially going to destroy their entire world?
What is the best line in Jurassic Park was Jeff Goldblum's when he said, just because you could doesn't mean you should.
Indeed. And that's the Arcadia. And he is in a fury that Arcadia, my villain, Aspirin Grayling, is in a fury that Arcadian scientists take that as a given, that just because you could doesn't mean you should. And what you need to have is you need to have wisdom before you have knowledge, because you need to know what you want to use that knowledge for, rather than just saying, we should just have as much knowledge as we possibly can. Well, why? You know who Aspirin is, really. He's Victor Frankenstein. He's an unrepentant Victor Frankenstein. He believes that the way Megalopolis operates is far better than the way Arcadia operates. He believes that power trumps love, that whatever is the most powerful should win, mainly because he had experiences when he was a child where the least powerful did not, in his eyes, win. So he allied himself with the most powerful against this little country.
And Sophia, the lizard princess, mm-hmm. Why does she think that power doesn't trump everything?
She believes where it went was Snotty was about a culture where power completely trumps love, and how do we deal with that? Lily was about Arcadia thinking it could trump power with love and that not being possible, because that is really what happens an awful lot of the time. A lot of the time on the left, and even without the violent left, which of course I totally disagree with any violence completely. I always say I'm as far on the left as you can possibly get without being violent, which I personally think is farther left than the violent ones, because it's just putting too much energy into the wrong thing. So, and then the third book, The Lizard Princess, is about Sophia learning how to balance love and power, and realizing that they have to be in partnership. And bringing that back to her country, and the country goes on from there. So that's why it's a trilogy, really, because it goes from power to love to power with love.
And to me, Sophia really learns how to deal with loss in creative ways, and that's part of life.
Yes.
and she can still have joy and continue on.
Well, and of course, one of her dearest mentors and friends is Death, who actually is my favorite character. And actually, Mike Madrid, who does the fantastic illustrations for the history of Arcadia, did a picture of Death with her hair just the way I wear my hair and a black turtleneck, which is usually what I wear. So that really cracked me up, especially since Todd, T-O-D, means death in German.
I did not.
It's another story. And it is my name. So I actually use the icon of Death for my icon whenever they ask me for a little widget, you know, and on Facebook, that's the one I use. I loved that. I opened it to Death and I went, oh, Mike, I see what you're doing.
Well, she is very prominent in the stories.
She is, yeah. And she should be. I mean, I think that that's another issue, is that Megalopolis has tried to get rid of Death, has said that Death doesn't exist. We are going to become immortal. Does that sound like anybody you know?
Mm-hmm. And they've created a second moon.
They have. They've created a false moon, which the Arcadians call the phony moon because they hate it so much, which is like the most beautiful place you could possibly go, where winter is the most beautiful winter and not cold.
But not life-sustaining.
Not life-sustaining. They can't actually. They keep that a secret. They actually have to send people back down to the planet, to the actual planet, to actually breathe in what's going on Earth. I cannot tell you how often when I read this stuff about how we are all going to go to Mars, I mean, I'm just like, do you really want to live on Mars?
I know.
And then I just read the most hilarious book, which it's not unintentionally hilarious, which apparently was hugely influential. And people still read it in Silicon Valley, called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. It was written in 1930 by a scientist who updated it in 1976. He essentially says there are two kinds of human beings. There are human beings like you and me, Lynn, who like to be human and like to drink water and like to smell flowers.
We love this blue orb.
We love this blue orb. Well, he says, we've had it. He says, we can maybe, if we want to stay behind, that's fine. Maybe we can use Earth as a place where he calls them the mechanical people, can then use Earth as an experiment without people like you and me knowing we're being experimented on, and we can live down here in perfect peace and harmony while the mechanical people go to the stars and live inside of planets. Inside of planets. He's the one who came up with the idea of how you could hollow out. I mean, people are still excited about this idea, Bernals, that you can live in a hollowed out planet. I mean, think about that. Please think about that. I want everyone out there who's like into cybernetics and robots and thinking we're all going to go to the moon and go to the stars. Think about that. Think about living in the inside of a dead rock. Does that really appeal to you?
No.
So my villain, it does appeal to my villain. And I mean, that's when people say, well, I don't want to stop us from growing. We are cancerously growing in some areas as a culture. I mean, that is really, I think that when
you... Do you mean growth, like economic growth?
Well, in this case, I mean scientific knowledge.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there are things that we are finding out that we can do, which we should not do until we have figured out why are we doing them. It's quite frightening, really. I mean, I've been looking into what scientists are exploring right now, and it's quite frightening. Well, one of the things that they are exploring, which they tried to keep quite quiet, and I'm not making this up, it was in the New York Times and the Guardian before they managed to quiet it down again, is they are considering making a human being that has no parents by artificially creating the DNA. Now, that is truly insane.
Pretty Frankenstein.
It's exactly Frankenstein. I wonder what I'm writing about.
Stephen Hawking counseled against that, as I recall.
Did he? Mm-hmm. Well, that was smart of him. I mean, Stephen Hawking also says it's inevitable that we are going to destroy the planet and that we should immediately start moving to the stars.
And, oh, that's too bad.
Yeah,
that's
no, I think he failed a little in that one. That was an epic fail. Yeah. Say that again about that little blue planet.
This little blue orb.
We love it. We do love it.
I like being here.
And, you know, we are inextricably bound to it. We are humans. Although if they make a parentless human, what is that going to mean? Is that human going to have any kind of attachment to this world? Is that human going to have what we talked about? Is that human going to have inherited? Of course, it won't have inherited fairy tale and folk tale and legends.
That story has been in science fiction.
Indeed.
For a long time, Marge Piercy wrote a great book called He, She, and It about artificial life.
That.
Yeah, and it's got a golem in it.
And that is a golem.
Like a sixth, yes, yes.
It is a golem.
Yeah.
And think of the warnings against golems for how many centuries now. But the scientific, this bit of the scientific community is so separated from that kind of wisdom, from the wisdom that comes from what they think of as childish tales about how human beings might want to live. It's in their subconscious, and they're probably kicking against it because they were weak when they were children. They don't want to be weak. People don't want to be weak. You have to accept that we are weak, and you have to accept that we die. I really don't see that there's – I mean, we need to accept that. To just keep kicking up against it just causes more havoc.
What is the one fellow one time – we are of bodies and we will die. And we are animals.
And fabulous. Think of all the things we get because of that, and think what we get because of the limitation of that. I mean, a poem has to have limitation. We are an art piece. You have to think about it that way. And I personally do not believe – I mean, I personally definitely do not believe that when you die, the energy just dies. That's impossible to me. So I want to make my art piece as kind and as creative as I possibly can, because I will have manifested all of that. I will have brought all that into the world.
And that will be your story.
And then I can go away. Exactly. So an eternity of symbols is out there, and that we feel certain symbols as things are changing, and then we bring them to birth. We manifest them, say. I mean, I think that everything out there is the unmanifest that we're bringing into form, and that's what we're doing with stories, and that's continually happening. And what I've got is I've got competing points of view in the history of Arcadia. I've got the point of view that says, no, we are little cogs in a machine that... And then I'm always thinking, when these people say things like that, what is the goal here? Are you saying that because I'm a little cog in a machine, I'm just supposed to perform in the way that you think I should? So for the future, which is brings us to my cookbooks, why they are called Jam Today, because it comes. There's no jam in the cookbooks, guys. If you're a jam person out there, don't read the cookbooks because they don't have any jam in them.
But they have other wonderful things.
Yeah. It's a quote from Alice in Wonderland where the queen says to Alice, there is always jam yesterday and jam tomorrow, but there is never jam today. And Alice says, surely sometime there must be jam today. And the queen says, there is never jam today. And I do feel that way when I read a lot of this technological predictions, is they're essentially saying there will be jam tomorrow. Just work harder. Well, wait a minute.
And that's a whole paradigm,
yes,
that we don't even have time to get into, of being a complacent worker and consumer.
Thank goodness for KBOO.
Yes.
So the radio station of the non-complacent.
That is the understatement of the century. Well, thank you, Todd Davies, for being with us this morning. It is always a joy to talk to you. And the importance of story, it is an important thing. I hope we gave folks a couple things to think about. So your next book is going to, do you have a title for it?
Report to Megalopolis.
We will look forward to that and hopefully have a conversation about that when it comes out in...
2018.
All right.
May 2018.
All right.
The subtitle is The Postmodern Prometheus.
Excellent. Well, you've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm Lynn Mullock. I've been talking with Todd Davies this morning. If you came in the middle of the conversation and you want to hear everything that we said, it will be up on our website at kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. Thank you all for tuning in. And SW Concert, thank you so much for producing this morning.
And thank you both.